Book of Jonah is quite an interesting book. It's always been an interesting book, certainly for kids. To this day, it's still debated whether what is contained in the book is real or more symbolic, even among evangelicals. And nothing wrong with thinking it's symbolic. Even if it's symbolic, there's still a meaning behind those symbols. But if you find it symbolic, then you'll have to go back to stories of Moses and find a lot of symbols there, or Abraham or Noah. And really, the Old Testament is going to be just a huge lump of symbols. But whatever we decide we see in the book, I think it's a literal depiction of what occurred. It is an interesting book. Jonah is the single most rebellious child of God you would see in Scripture. And I say single most rebellious in terms of the description of his reluctance to follow God. It's not seen anywhere else, really, especially when you consider the context of Jonah. And his name means dove. It definitely doesn't act like one. When I think of dove in the Bible, I think of one, the one that came back to, or that was sent to find the land, and that came back with, you know, hope. He's not a prophet of hope. definitely not. But he's a well-known prophet, prophesied around Amos, Hosea, during the reign of Jeroboam II. And here, in the beginning of the book, he tells us that he is the son of Amittai. Now, the name Jonah also appears again in 2 Kings, chapter 14, where it gives us a little bit of background of this prophet. But before we get there, can I have the first map, just so we have a good picture of what is going on during this time? In the years of Jeroboam, the previous one. Oh no, this is the one we have. Oh yes. So this here, if you can distinguish between the two colors, I hope some of you guys are not colorblind, but you can see those two shades of green. Okay, the first, the short or the smaller one, is the kingdom of Assyria before they take over all of this region. Now, you know that they're coming for Israel at one point. Israel is here. You see Judah here is somehow depicted. It's kind of yellow. But Assyria becomes a huge power at one point. And somehow they would take over all of this land, including Egypt. Now, Babylon, now the capital of Assyria is Nineveh, right here. And Babylon is this area here. Later on, this is Babylon, the city, but it becomes the whole empire. So after Babylon takes over Assyria, they're just going to take Judah into captivity. But at this point, Assyria is just this small. And they are going through internal struggles. They have always been through internal struggles for centuries. If you guys remember Ur of the Chaldeans, you guys remember the very early civilizations with Abraham coming out of there and going to the land that the Lord is showing him. And since then, it's always been a very, this is one of the most, the oldest cities in the world. Babylon is also one. Nineveh is one. And this is where the power of the Assyrian Empire lies. And at this time, they are fighting a few people. They are fighting the Babylonians. They are fighting the kingdom of Urartu. And they are also fighting these enemies here in Samaria. And inside, power struggles. People who were there before are pushing away those who are coming. The Babylonians, who feel this is their land and they are being taken as vessels of the Assyrian dynasties. So At that point, Israel, through Jeroboam, is taking back a lot of their land that were taken through various battles. And so they conquer back some of this land. They also move back east of the Dead Sea. And they take on a little bit of land here. Now, at this point, this is the farthest they have went to before the captivity. When we go to 2 Kings, one thing I'd like you to notice before we speak of Jonah. Now, Jonah was a prophet during the reign of Jeroboam. And in 2 Kings chapter 14, it says, in the 15th year of Amaziah, the son of Josh, king of Judah, Jeroboam, the son of Josh, king of Israel, so these are two Josh, king of Judah and Israel, Jeroboam becomes king of Israel in Samaria, and he reigns for 41 years. It says right away, he did evil in the sight of the Lord. He did not depart from all the sins of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, which he made in Israel. He restored the border of Israel from the entrance of Hamath as far as the sea of Araba, according to the word of the Lord. So the Lord has already prophesied that Israel would take back some of this territory. And this Lord had prophesied through a prophet, and it says here through the prophet Jonah. So during the reign of Jeroboam, Jonah is prophesying something good for the land. I want you to see the context in which this man is being sent to Nineveh. He is in Israel prophesying, and he would be a prophet for almost 40 years, but not during, it doesn't say exactly whether he started, when the king started and went through it all, but it simply says during those days, Jonah was prophesying what the Lord was about to do for Israel. So it's good job for Israel. And he's telling them, listen, don't worry. The Lord is telling me we are going to take back our land. Keep in mind this. Jeroboam did evil in the eyes of the Lord all the days of his life. And he did not depart from the sins of his father Jeroboam. Now, Jeroboam the first is the first king of Israel. I'd like you to have an idea of the sins of this one Jeroboam that we hear about many, many times after, through many kings. Now, the first Jeroboam, we are told, his sins are already seen from the beginning when the kingdoms are divided. The kingdom of Israel and Judah is divided. His primary sin is said to be idolatry. He created false gods. Not only he created false gods, but you remember in one of the previous slides, Jerusalem was the place of pilgrimage for the Israelites to come and worship the Lord. But because these were divided, the kingdom was divided, he decided, okay, we're going to cut that pilgrimage. We're going to create two cities. One was in Dan and one in Bethel. And he decides, well, actually Bethel is closer and Dan is over there. And he decides that's where we are going to worship now. As a matter of fact, let's put some idols there. He put two golden calves in each one, and that becomes the center of worship in Israel since the divided kingdom, right after Solomon, all the way to the captivity. Of course, some kings would have removed that, but at the end, there still were many of those idols were there. In 1 Kings 12, it says here, it is too much for you to go up to Jerusalem. Here are your gods, Israel, who brought you out of Egypt. One golden calf he set up in Bethel and the other in Dan. And this thing became sin. The people came to worship the one at Bethel and went as far as Dan to worship the other. Not only he bought those calves there, but he appointed just about anybody to be priest. God has appointed one people, one tribe to priesthood. Jeroboam decides, you know what, listen, the priesthood, we can just take anybody. Those who are not Levites, you qualify, just come and do the work. It's easy to do for everyone. Really, you don't need any credentials for it. But when you hear what Jeroboam has done, in contrast to what God has promised him in 1 Kings 11, this is what God promised Jeroboam. If you do whatever I command, and you walk in obedience to me, and do what is right in my eyes, and by obeying my decrees and commands, as David my servant did, I will be with you. I will build you a dynasty as enduring as the one I built for David, and will give you Israel. He had God by his side. This is not someone who just fought for power. Yes, he did fight for power during the division of the kingdom, but God was with him. God promised protection to him. But he didn't want to have Jerusalem on the other side of the border. He had this competition with his brothers, and he decides, no, I'm going to have my own. I will build my own land. I will build my own worship. And I will worship God the way I see it. Of course, after Jeroboam the first, many of the kings who followed him, Zimri, Omri, Amaziah, Pekahiah, many of those kings simply followed and never departed from the ways of this Jeroboam. And it is said here that while Jonah is prophesying in Israel, Jeroboam the second departs from none of those. So he has idol worships. He has metal statues that people would come and worship. He has more than Levites to minister. And Jonah is ministering there, telling them exactly what the Lord said, by the way. I'm not criticizing Jonah at this point. I'm just saying at this point he's telling them what the Lord said. I will give you back your land. I will secure the promised land of Israel, or the land of Israel, despite his enemies. Now, a little bit after Jonah, Amos, we actually already saw what Amos said, Hosea as well, they prophesied against Jonah, against Israel. They said, there is sin in your midst, and the Lord will punish you. He will bring your enemies to your doors, and they will put you to your knees. So they had very harsh, harsh predictions against Israel. Jonah was about the opposite. So Jonah, for many years, has preached the salvation of the Lord by the hand of Jeroboam, the one who did evil in the eyes of the Lord. What am I saying? I am saying maybe he grew callous to the sins of this world because of the message he had. He was not a bad prophet in this context, because God sent other prophets to speak to Israel and tell them, listen, this is wrong. The sin that is in your midst is wrong. But Jonah was sent to prophesy of God's salvation of Israel. Now, from the get-go, at this point, you would think that this is a prophet who understands compassion, because he can see wickedness in the land. He can see false worship in the land, and yet he can preach salvation. Now, this very context has been also the source of some debate as to whether Jonah actually wrote this book. I am on the fence for two reasons. First of all, if it doesn't say necessarily that it is a book of Jonah, it only starts as identifying Jonah as the one who will be who is the prophet who receives the word of the Lord. So the word came to Jonah is the beginning of the book, not that the book was written by him. One of the arguments, really, that people look at to say, was this written by Jonah, is simply that he was just too blunt about the prophet's sins. Now, when you know the prophet himself, you wouldn't think he would be that, honest about his own sins. But when you read his prayer, to me, I say, yes, he could be. He could possibly write a book like this. But if he had written a book like this, it would not have ended as abruptly as it has, simply with a question. I think somehow for him to write this kind of letter, he would have, you write it because you want to show that you understood the message of the Lord. But there is really no indication of that for Jonah. But regardless, the point is not who wrote the book, but why is the book written? And I think the last section of it tells us in chapter 3, verse 4. In chapter 4, verse 10, he asked in verse 9 the question to Jonah, do you have a good reason to be angry about the plant? And Jonah responds really with saying, I have a good reason. And God tells him this, which is the theme of all of the whole book. He said, verse 11, should I not have compassion on Nineveh, the great city? Should I not have compassion on Nineveh, the great city? This is the theme of the whole book. The whole book is a setting for us to understand God's compassion for those who are in sin. The whole story. We can get caught up on some of the details of the story, but if we miss this grand theme, we have misunderstood Jonah. That's why I see Jonah as a book describing God, even though one of the main characters is Jonah. And other characters, Nineveh, and the sailors. But it is really about God. Should I not have compassion? It tells us about God and directly challenges us about ourselves. Those are the two points in this book, and that's what we are going to be looking at. In the whole book, you expect it's a book about a prophet, so you expect a prophecy. And in four chapters, Jonah the prophet simply gave a few words. In chapter 3, verse 4, yet 40 days and Nineveh will be overthrown. I mean, how reluctant are you going to be? Go preach a message. He just goes and gives this one sentence. He's gone. He walked one full day into the city, gave the message. He's gone, hoping they won't hear it. Somebody hears it, goes to the king. This is what Jonah said, the prophet, and then it's just repentance throughout the city. What a difference with Israel at that time. Israel protected by God to enlarge its borders and worshiping false idols, worshiping golden calves and metal objects, violating every law about the worship of God. And God is with them. And you have one here, the prophet, coming from that very Israel, reluctant to demonstrate or to call to repentance because we have a compassionate God, a God who has shown Israel compassion. Now, the reluctance of Jonah can hardly be missed. It can hardly be mitigated. It is clear from the very beginning of the book. when God calls Jonah in verse 2, "Rise, go to Nineveh, the great city, and cry against it, for their wickedness has come before me." Cry against it. That was the wrong word for Jonah. Immediately it tells us that he arose, but he rose and he flee to Tarshish. And the term there, "from the presence of the Lord," is an indication of his motives. I want you to see in the next slide here just how far the guy, I don't know why he was trying that, but this is where he is. This is Nineveh, which is quite far. But this is Tarshish right here. So he took a boat. I don't understand. He was trying to sail far away from the Lord. The guy who preaches a God who's capable to save a nation is running away from that same God. If he can take nations, do you think he can take a boat? Like, try to. Sometimes we have the, you know, we react in a way that is inconsistent with the God we serve. And it's good to explore the reasons. Like I used to debate with Armenians. I mean, strong debate. I mean, they were heated debates. And I was trying to debate and defending the fact that God is sovereign. He's the one who opens the heart of the people. For someone who was saying, no, he doesn't. And we were butting heads, and I, the one who's sovereign grace, trying to open the heart of this stubborn Armenian that, listen, God opened the heart. He's the one opening the heart, and I'm trying to open his heart. Like, from the very beginning in this debate, I'm the one in error. I mean, I understand him. He's saying it's man's effort. Yes, there is God's sovereignty, but man has a lot to do with it, and he's the determining factor. So he's right in debating, because he debates according to his knowledge. But if I preach sovereign grace, if I say God is capable to do everything, God is the one who brings you out of darkness into light. He's the one who gives you an insight into knowing him and loving him. And I try to unlock your heart, something is wrong. It's a Jonah symptom, if I would say. So Jonah takes the boat right here, and he's trying to flee as far as he knows he can go. Probably as far as he can afford. And yet Nineveh is right there. And the key word in God's command that causes Jonah to flee is to cry. He didn't say warn. Say cry. So immediately he knows God is compassionate. He doesn't miss it. I want you to know, at no point in time, at this point, Jonah does not miss the fact that God has compassion. He confesses it in chapter 4, in verse 2. The second time, well, actually, when after the repentance, Jonah prays to God, and he says, "I knew that you are a gracious and compassionate God, slow to anger and abundant in loving kindness, and one who relents concerning calamity." I knew that. Actually, previous to that, later on, he actually tells them, oh yes, "Therefore, in order to forestall this, I fled to Tarshish." He actually acknowledges to God, "Listen, when you told me the first time to go. I knew you were compassionate. I tried to stop this. God, you were way too compassionate. You should have sent me rather to tell them how done they are. This gives us a window into our hearts. When I listen to Jonah, I tend to easily, well, I think usually I don't go that far, but when you really think about it, we do. We like giving God suggestions as to how things should go. Someone is in sin, really, really grave sin, and what you want to do is simply have them broken completely. You want God to punish them so bad it's going to make an example of them, rather than the other way around. God having compassion. God, please have compassion. That's not the first thing we have in mind when we are either victim of the person's sin or circumstances. Last thing we want is to hear them have compassion. When you have someone who mocks your God and finds every opportunity to use his name in vain in front of you, the first thing that comes is not, "Oh Lord, have compassion over him." You actually want God to demonstrate to this person how strong, how powerful, how vengeful he is. When you stand with Stephen Hawking, the evolutionist? He did? When? Oh, no, I'm not thinking of Hawking. He's the one who's a paraplegic, right? No, I'm thinking of the Dawkins, Richard Dawkins. When someone is like that, you tend to want God to come on the scene right in this debate and just fry the guy or do something just to demonstrate that, listen, God is real and he can show you. But we don't see the pain of the person there because of how tough they look and how tough they speak. But listen, even when they speak tough, there is pain behind. This is someone who is in need of salvation. If he was in need of justice, so would you. So would you be. God showed me mercy, and oftentimes I forget that mercy. God showed Israel mercy, showed Jonah mercy, and Jonah continues to forget. Jonah seemed to have been a nationalist, someone who's pro-Israel and just against any nation. Any non-Israel nation, I'm just against. It doesn't matter what Israel does. Really, it doesn't, because at this point, Israel is in deep sin. He's not even serving the God who's protecting them, serving two calves who can do nothing for them, or the metal idols who can do nothing for them. You are the one who does something for these idols. You have to carry them. You have to shape them. You have to clean them. They will never bring anything to you. No rain, no crops, no fertility, nothing. But the one God who says, "I will sustain and grow your land," you betray. For someone to be so pro-Israel, he must have lost his vision as a prophet. But it tells us two things in this book about man's heart. When God calls us, he doesn't just expect us to know him. When God calls, he doesn't just expect us to know him. We know God. God expects us to obey him. He expects you to follow him. You can say God all day long, You can tell him how much you love him all day long. Unless you follow him, you are simply a Jonah. You remember that even while he was running on the ship in chapter 1, when they find out, when they pray to God and the sea is going wild, and these folks are afraid, terrified of what could happen to the boat, it's about to break. They say, no, we have been praying and nothing happens. There is still one person in this boat who hasn't prayed. And it's very weird because he's sleeping. We are sailors, we are afraid. He's not a sailor and he's sleeping down there. And they simply did the math and they say, come on, you tell us something. And the question just come out of their mouth without stopping. Tell us now, on whose account has this calamity struck us? What is your occupation? And where do you come from? What is your country? From what people are you? And he tells them the truth. Even though he is trying to flee from this God, he is still an orthodox servant. An orthodox servant, the one who knows the truth. He just doesn't comply to it. He tells them, I fear the Lord God of heaven, who made the sea and the dry land. Of all the people I'm going to meet in heaven, and I hope I'm going to meet Jonah, this is the person I would like to have a conversation with. I know I'm a sinner, I know, but I'd like to understand what he had in his mind. Because growing up, I couldn't escape my dad. I mean, he's trying to escape God. I could not escape my dad. Because he had a network of people well placed in high places and in low places. He would find you anywhere. He would just send the word out there. Someone will find you and bring you back. Not that I wanted to escape. Never cared about escaping. But it's just other people that he found. That's why I say you couldn't escape him. Not that we were afraid to leave, but when he found people, even when he didn't know them, he could just pick up the phone, call his younger brother, who knows a lot of people in low places, and he says, I want to find this person. This is the name, and I believe this is the school he goes to. Just with a name. I tell you, we have people like the LeBlanc. You give them a LeBlanc name, and they're going to find that person. With a little description, they find him. Now, he wasn't God. I'm pretty sure I could escape him if I wanted to. But Jonah, he knows that he confesses this is the God who created the heavens and the earth. And at this time, he is fleeing from him. And I believe that Jonah was taking the compassion for granted. He knew that compassion applied to him. If Jonah had the picture of God as he did, without the compassion applied to him, he would have been scared. But he knew God had compassion. This is very much the condition under which we tend to overlook what God is requiring from us. We take for granted the blood of Christ. We take it for granted. We get comfortable that we are in. And the rest, yeah, well, we can do. But it's not a law. It's not like, you know, if I don't do it, I'm going to be unsaved. We always bring it to that crucial question. Is that going to save? Well, that doesn't matter anymore. You are saved. The question is, will you give him the glory? Will the name of Christ be sweet in your mouth, coming from your heart, not simply lip service, but rather heart service? You belong to him. consider again that that position. Doesn't that make you sing? Doesn't that make you want to do more for him? Let's not grow complacent. Jonah is a complacent prophet. Complacency is not the only thing. There is also a lot of hatred in Jonah's heart. Lots of it. I mean, the Assyrians are coming, and they are known to be wicked people. I mean, not just among believers in Israel, but among the nations surrounding them. They have very mean and evil ways to torture people. Their plans for prisoners of war are not pleasing. You're not just going to be in forced labor. They are known for their ruthlessness around, and Israel for sure despised them. Jonah demonstrates the heart of the Israelites. Now, I know we've had those questions and sometimes the debate as to whether a Christian can hate someone else. And I think the Sunday school answer should be no. But how close do we come to that as believers? And what leads us to that? I'd like to venture to say two things. Number one is the fact that we do hate sin. We absolutely hate sin as believers. It's something repulsive. But on the other hand, what uses that hatred of sin is not the Spirit of God. It's oftentimes our own flesh using it. Because the sin of the other is so ugly and I'm not that bad. The moment it turns against me, my hatred for it becomes from the flesh. I mean, I just illustrated that. I know I'm a sinner. I wouldn't do this. And I know I wouldn't do it. What I didn't tell you is what else would I do that Jonah wouldn't do? We don't talk like that. We don't emphasize ours. We emphasize other people's. Because to me, I would probably go just as far as here and then get scared, come back. But he was kind of willing to go through all of the storm. Many times they try to even have pity on him, not throw him overboard. They said, you know what, I don't want to kill someone over this. Let's just try to row to back to shore. They tried, and it just got scarier. They pleaded with God before they threw the guy overboard. That's how reluctant he was to actually do whatever he wanted. I wouldn't do that. And I'm being honest. But when my flesh kicks in, when your flesh kicks in, you look at the sins of the others and you see how bad these people are, or how immature the person is, or how wrong they are. Everything somehow is limited to this one place of comparison where you have the upper hand. Oftentimes, this leads us to look down on others, despise them, and for some, flat out hate others. When you have one place of comparison where you are, you have the upper hand. That uses your hatred for sin as a tool to put down other men. Jonah was right there. It gives us a window to man's heart, but mostly Jonah gives us an understanding that the plan of God is consistent throughout history. That the plan of God is consistent throughout history. And as that point is made, we also drive the point that his plan is consistent throughout our lives. in the Lord's in Psalm 23, the Lord's my shepherd, in verse 3 it says, surely goodness and mercy will follow me all the days of my life. Goodness and mercy will be with me always. Is that something we can bank on? Is that a guarantee that goodness and mercy will always be with us? Well, the God who doesn't change says precisely that. It's only going to change when God changes. When he stops being God, when he stops being omniscient, when he stops being all wise, all powerful, when something there stops, then yes, whatever he told you, you can reconsider. I wouldn't suggest to wait for it. In 2 Timothy chapter 4, verse 18, Paul himself has this confidence. When he speaks to Timothy, he says, the Lord will rescue me from every evil deed, and he will bring me safely to his heavenly kingdom. This is after he's speaking of what many of the people who are opposing him are trying to do to him. They are even seeking his life, but he has a confidence somewhere. He has a confidence. The Lord will rescue me. I love Psalm 121. If you are in the habit of memorizing Psalms, this is one of those that you want to memorize. A beautiful Psalm, short, it's only 8 verses, but it tells us about this God and how we can rest on him. He says, I will lift up my eyes to the mountains. From where shall my help come? This is a good psalm to remember, because we tend to look for help in many places. Many places. Even when we know God is next to us. My help comes from the Lord who made heaven and earth. I pray that we are not simply orthodox in our theology, but also we have an orthopraxy, the right living based on that teaching. Because if you remember, these are the words of Jonah. I serve the Lord who made the heavens and the earth. And he could even put in the same sentence, no, I'm running away from the God who can stop me anytime. That's exactly what he's saying. And I don't want us to have that heart. I want us to be able to say this, knowing this, and resting on the help that comes from him. He will not allow your foot to slip. He will not allow your foot to slip. He who keeps you will not slumber. I like this picture. It is a depiction of our weakness. If I ask you to watch over something, chances are you will slumber. I remember that. I was a scout. We used to have 2-hour watch at camp. And each person would take 2, and we would be 2 at a time. Someone would just walk around the camp. The other one would keep the fire. And we'll switch like that for 2 hours. So when you know each other, you're friends, you decide to just be lazy and sit and talk. And then when the talk starts slowing down, after a while, you maybe hear someone just snoring. Usually when the chief of the camp hears that, he knows somebody's not doing his job, he will wake up. But the problem is when he doesn't wake up, you don't wake up, you don't call the other guys who are supposed to take over to wake up. They just doze off and sleep. It's hard for us to keep awake. But God does not slumber. You cannot feel unsafe with a God who can't sleep, who is always going to and fro the earth, who is ensuring that you are safe. He never slumbers nor sleep. Behold, he who keeps Israel will neither slumber nor sleep. He who keeps his children will neither slumber nor sleep. The Lord is your keeper. The Lord is your shade on your right hand. I know many people who are very safe because of maybe they are the entourage, the president of the United States, the prime minister of Canada, safe people. I mean, it's hard to just get to them. Someone is going to get to you before that. But even they are not that safe, because we know many of them who die. But you have one who does not sleep nor slumber, and who keeps you. These are the things that when we memorize, it helps us go day by day, because we are threatened all day long. And very often we feel the threat. We simply do not acknowledge that we are threatened. Whether it's the language or the temptations to do something wrong, the temptations to make the wrong purchase, knowing that this is not really for me, I'm not sure if this is right, it's too much, our budget doesn't allow it, and you just go ahead and do it. You don't ask your spouse, you simply go and then you're going to fix it later. Well, sometimes when you have, you know, memory of a God who keeps you and who has eyes on you, you tend to do different. The sun will not smite you by day, nor the moon by night. That's kind of funny text at this point, because I remember that the sun did smite Jonah. The Lord will protect you from all evil. By the way, that's not what it means. It's not a literal smiting. What he's trying to say simply is that you won't be a victim of the elements, because we are much smaller before the elements, tornadoes, whatever else. We have really no power against them. Even after, you know, thousands of years after this is written, we still have no power against the elements. We've tried. We are tiny before them, but listen, they will not kill you. The Lord will protect you from all evil. He will keep your soul. The Lord will guard your going out and your coming in from this time forth, and forevermore. What a God we serve. That's the God of Jonah. The whole book hinges around this one God. Will he not have compassion? And if there is anything that I like us, that I like to challenge us to do, is first that we read Jonah often with a new light. What are the Nineveh around me? What are the Nineveh around me, unbelievers, primarily around me, that I have a hard time sharing the gospel to because of my heart? Move that also to those unbelievers that I have a hard time. They already heard it. God is the God of compassion, and he will come until you receive it. Are you going to be the Jonah or make a difference? But not only that, I want you to also know, what are the Israelites of your life? Who are the Israelites of your life? It's those whose sin you are tolerating. Maybe you have a hard time going to a brother. You have too much respect for him. You have someone who's, maybe they're already suffering. You don't want to add to their suffering. And you don't tell them about their sins. For God, because God will come for them. He will do whatever it takes. You remember what he did for Jonah. He did whatever it took to ensure that his servant follow him. Why aren't you that agent of compassion of God? Plead with a person. I want you to read Jonah and do the two words that come, that start in verse 2, chapter 1. Arise and go. Arise and go. And cry against those who are not doing the will of God. The God of compassion is the one who gave us, who demonstrated to us how much he loves us.